It's Let's Talk Legal on the TalkStation FM 107.1, brought to you by the folks at Harvell and Collins. And always to remind you, you can reach out to them in any fashion you consider. But I would say consider giving them a phone call, 252 area code 726-9050. Or, of course, you can do it via the digital media. Just reach out to them through their website at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, as we always remind you, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, we're joined today by Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. And to the two of you, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Lockwood. Good afternoon,
Lockwood.
So what is the topic for the day?
Lockwood, the last couple of afternoons that we've been together, we've been discussing some of the will caveats, challenging a will, upsetting a will, having issues concerning the validity and the legality of a last will and testament. Our office sees a lot of inquiries in this area of the law, as well as we handle quite a few cases in this area of the law. And so we just thought we would continue with that topic today. One of the things that was mentioned is that a will challenge, or known as a caveat to a will, is an action that gets filed initially in the clerk of court, where of course the will would be filed. Mm-hmm. And Wes, the statute of limitations on that is 3 years, isn't it?
3 years, that's correct.
Right. So it's, Lockwood, if one wishes to challenge a will that has been filed and placed into the probate process, then one has 3 years to bring their caveat proceeding. What's interesting about that proceeding is that immediately the case then is moved to Superior Court, and as we discussed last week, the case will then involve the paneling of a jury, mm-hmm. which I think is fascinating in that that is not typical. Usually a jury trial is something that Wes would demand, ask for, even sometimes fight for, if you will. But in a caveat proceeding, it's an automatic rule of law that the hearing of the validity of the will would be heard by a jury. And so with that, we'll just keep moving. And if there are any questions, let us know.
You know, I do have two quick questions. One, I'm surprised, you know, obviously we're focusing on this topic of will caveats, but it leads to a question probably later to the end that obviously there are challenges out there. I never would have imagined that, and I'm wondering why. But the other aspect of this, on the issue of the jury trial, that's interesting in the sense that it's going to require presentation of evidence, and that must be pretty significant.
It is. It's, you know, obviously there's burdens that each side has. You know, when you're in any trial, especially a jury trial, you have to be, as an attorney, concerned about who has what burdens, mm-hmm. because you have to carry that burden with evidence. You can't just show up and argue your position without evidence, you know, supporting that burden. And, you know, in the event that you don't have evidence to support your burden, or you fail to put on the necessary evidence, then the court is empowered to grant a directed verdict. And that means that the court finds, again, that the evidence that you put on does not meet the requirements for this case to go to a jury. And so you kind of see, as we've talked about before, and I mentioned last week on the program, summary judgment, you kind of see that summary judgment would be a mechanism to resolve the case before it ever gets to the jury because of the weakness of the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
That in the event that's denied and you go forward with the case, that in no way affects the authority of the trial court to grant such a motion, which is called a directed verdict, if you have a jury in a trial setting, if the evidence is not sufficient. So in a will caveat case, you know, the initial burden is with the party who says that the will is the valid will. Okay, uh-huh. You would think, and then let me make this simple, because I'm getting a little bit complicated here, and I don't mean to be, but you would think that the initial burden would be in a caveat with the party who is challenging the will.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that kind of feels like that's the right thing to do, because, okay, well, you're challenging it, so you have to start. And then once you put on evidence of undue influence or lack of capacity or medical records or, you know, experts regarding dementia, Alzheimer's, presentations, those kind of things, neighbors, well, whoever the witnesses are you put on, then the burden then shifts over to the other side to put on, you know, evidence in response to that. Well, that's under the law and under our statutes, dealing with caveats, that's not the order of presentation. Actually, the party who has the initial burden is the party who says the will is the will. Really the person you would think would be the defendant, but they're really treated as the plaintiff. And so they have to put on the will. I had one case in particular where I was in the I was challenging, you know, the will. This was a will that was signed right before a elderly gentleman passed away, and I won that case on directed verdict and never had to put on any evidence before a jury, because opposing counsel failed to put on the evidence necessary to prove that the will was the will. And that evidence is simple. I mean, it is the document itself, it's the witnesses, it's the notary would be appropriate, and there was a failure to do that, and I moved for a directed verdict because the law is clear on that, and the court did what it had to do and granted my directed verdict. Now, so that's a, you know, that's kind of one of those pitfalls, really, that you hear about, that when the other side has an attorney, you better have an attorney.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, again, that's just one of those things that when you know how these work, then you can take advantage of mistakes of the other side, and that's a big part of what litigation is about. In all candor.
Wes, so, a quick question on the issue of the challenge of a will. In the capacity as the challenger, do you have to provide evidence to the other party, in this case the defendant or the person who says the will is the will? Do you provide evidence in advance to share with them why you determine you've made that, or you're challenging the will? Or is that presented only in the case of the court?
Yeah, we absolutely. The parties on both sides should know the scope globally of all of the evidence that could potentially come in before we ever start the trial.
Okay.
And that is because we go through the process of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is, okay, we send written discovery requests to identify anyone who may have any information, you know, regarding the capacity of, you know, the person who died, for example,
mm-hmm.
and the basis of that. Now, you don't always know exactly what all of those witnesses are going to say. You normally are going to see every piece of paper, every document, because there's no reason that a party would not produce a document prior to the trial. But you may not know exactly what every witness will say because, you know, the response to that question, identifying anyone who has any information regarding capacity, for example, or regarding any issues relevant to the allegations in the complaint, well, the response to that may be 50 people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my client may not want to pay me to take the deposition of 50 people, because that would be very expensive.
Right.
So we kind of, you know, look at the list and make the determination as to who we, you know, think that it's most important to know what they would say. So, yes, it's the discovery process and the rules regarding discovery apply to caveats just like any other lawsuit. And, you know, for our office, and, you know, we have such a deep, you know, really history of dealing with estate-related litigation matters that, you know, we've pretty much seen every kind of permutation of caveats in these type cases. So it's not as though we have to go and reinvent the wheel every time we're in one of these cases. And what I mean by that is that your written discovery request, which are called interrogatories and requests for production of documents and requests for admissions, in most lawsuits, I mean, you really have to put your thinking cap on to make sure you're asking the correct questions. This is not just just have an associate try to throw it together. I mean, you've really got to think through all the elements of the case and the details and the nuances to make sure you cover everything. Well, in a caveat, a lot of caveats look the same. So, you know, in our office, we have, you know, different sets of discovery requests that we've used for different caveat cases, and so we're able to, you know, benefit from that and benefit the client from that as well, because we don't have to, like I said, reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. We have those go-bys that we can use, and the questions are all going to be, you know, very much similar. So we're able to move that process along quickly, very efficiently, and frankly,
Lockwood,
less effort.
Cecil?
Uh-huh.
Just to add to this, where we are right now in our conversation today, yes, Lockwood, this will caveat proceeding operates just like a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And we have discussed before in the program that one of the very important sections of a lawsuit, one of the stages, if you will, of litigation, is what's known as the discovery stage.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when the lawyers, party A and party B, ask questions of witnesses called depositions. This is when there are written interrogatories or questions that then must be answered. This is when there is production of documents, and in a will caveat case, of course, there would most likely be, it would be rare for there not to be, the production of all of the medical records, the medical notes of the doctors and nurses. There would be the depositions of the people who were in and around the testator, people who were in the home, his caregivers possibly, anything, any witness that might be called as a witness by Wes. Wes is certainly going to have on their deposition, and there will come a time, just like again in any litigation, when there's a deadline.
Right.
And the witnesses are disclosed, and the lawyers, if you don't have all of your witnesses on the disclosure, then potentially that witness would be, it would be deemed prejudicial for them to be called at the jury trial because the other lawyer did not have an opportunity to take their statement.
Got
called
you.
A deposition.
You know, that,
so it's out and out full litigation. All of the stages of litigation occur, including, of course, the stage of litigation that sometimes happens with regard to compromise and settlement.
Uh-huh.
Some of these cases, caveats, end up getting settled, just like any other lawsuit, Lockwood. So I just thought it was important to put the will caveat proceeding in perspective.
We're talking with, that's Cecil Harvell, we're talking with Cecil and Wes, Harvell and Collins, by the way, at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please. Just to remind you, feel free to give them a call, 252 area code 726-9050. We're talking about will caveats. And Wes, back to the observations you were making, and Cecil, same thing, on the issue of the interrogatories and the depositions and all the evidence. The forensic evidence necessary for the challenges seems significant. And You noted that it's a 3-year statute of limitations. Within that 3 years, boy, a lot can change. You can have the loss of witnesses through, death and or incapacity. Then the issue of documents. And that sounds to me like it becomes an extremely intense investigative effort, Wes.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, just like every litigation case, you know, when you're engaging in discovery, you know, you want to move pretty quickly, but that's all relative. What's moving pretty quickly for me may not be what moving pretty quickly for my client means, because
right.
We're used to things moving at the pace that you hear about. You know, the law moves very slowly.
Right. Let me give you an example, though, of one of the things that would concern me. Let's talk about medical records and the transition of individuals from one state to another state. You may be looking for an issue of capacity, for example, and looking at wanting to see the medical records. Acquiring those medical records sounds pretty daunting to me. I just know that sometimes doctors' offices aren't medical facilities are moving. They're transitioning too. That strikes me as a real challenge.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And, you know, normally when we get medical records in these cases, or when we produce them, depending on what side of the case we're on, you know, we're talking about thousands and thousands of pages of documents.
Right.
You know, so, you know, we're poring over these. I mean, frankly, you're able to, kind of get drilled down to the issues pretty quickly, though, when you're reviewing these documents. The production has to be very broad, but then you're able to, if you're skilled in doing this, if you're used to looking at medical records, which, we certainly are, because, we deal with this all the time, then, you can get to, kind of break it down into an outline of these are the areas where it was that are relevant to the case, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And normally, you're going to see some things in those medical records, like your typical, like triage-type notes, your initial intake notes. You may have nurses' notes. You may then have doctor's notes. And some of the things that we used to seeing, of course, are going to be, the neuro part, the part dealing with capacity, where there's the oriented section. You need to know what that means. And what that is like oriented times 3 or 4 would be, full capacity,
mm-hmm.
At that point in time. So if you see, oriented times 3 or 4, that means time, person, place. You add 4 would be situation. So if you see an oriented times 2 or an oriented times 1, that means at the time that this person was being evaluated, then there was they were diminished in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's pretty basic. Obviously, if we have a oriented times 1 or 2, there's normally going to be some notes as well where there's conversation with the patient with regard to the things they may or may not know, who's with them, are they able to make decisions, that type of thing. So you're able to drill down into that without having necessarily a medical degree to understand every nuance of the of the medical records. So yes, I mean, getting to the bottom of the situation as it relates to how the person really was presenting, the medical records are invaluable as it relates to that, because normally medical records are going to be very complete. Now, you also have to look at what kind of medical records we're getting, though. Mm-hmm. When the issue is capacity and whether the person was able to make decisions for himself or herself, whether the person was feeble, whether the person may have been more likely subjectable to undue influence, then someone's dental records might not, they're going to the dentist might help very much. They might not help at all because they went, because they went to see the dentist.
Mm-hmm.
They're not looking at issues with regard to capacity and those type things. If the person, had a a skin irritation, and that's why they're at the doctor. There might not be anything. Mm-hmm. But if it's, you know, a lot of times we see, you know, in elderly folks, you know, they've got, you know, maybe a UTI issue going on. They have, you know, other health issues. And normally if we're looking at medical records from, you know, family doctor or the internist, you know, that's, you know, normally the primary physician, then in many cases those are going to be much, much broader records and going to, you know, provide more information regarding how the person presented from a capacity standpoint during that appointment. And then obviously we're wanting to look at the records around the time of period that the period of time that the subject will was signed.
Mm-hmm.
It may not make any difference that, you know, we have records 4 years after the will was signed and the person isn't presenting very well at that point in time. That might not matter because the person may have had a, you know, significant, you know, downfall as it relates to their capacity during that 4 year period of time. But we don't have to have records on Lockwood on the exact same day either.
Okay.
You know, if we have records that are leading up to the time that the will, you know, may have been signed or was signed, indicating that there is a diminished capacity and maybe even indicating that that diminished capacity is getting worse as time goes on, then that certainly would be relevant to the issue of, you know, whether they had the capacity to, you know, to execute and properly execute under North Carolina law and have the capacity to execute a valid will. So the medical record part of a will caveat is vital, is something that, you know, you don't leave out. You always get those records. And, you know, I can think of, you know, right now, multiple cases where kind of the smoking gun, so to speak, mm-hmm. is found in the medical records, where, you know, you don't know what those records are going to say until you get them, and then you get them, and it's like, well, you know, I have one I can think of, but there's multiple, but one was so egregious. It was a case, it wasn't a caveat, actually. It was a case where the son of the elderly lady had gotten her to change all of her beneficiary designations mm-hmm. to just him and took the daughter off, okay? And his contention was that's what she wanted because he was helping to take care of her. And the medical record, you know, first of all, we took the deposition early of the doctor and did not have all of the records. And it happened to be that the doctor was a friend of the son, so he testified very favorably for the son.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then we got the rest of the medical records. There was kind of a side story about why we didn't have them all from the beginning. But we got the rest of the medical records and saw that the doctor indicated that, you know, the mother is here with her son. She can't make decisions for herself.
Okay.
I am very impressed with the how significantly her dementia has advanced since we last met. She will need to, for the rest of her life, operate, or her affairs will need to be taken care of through power of attorney. Okay, you know, that's kind of a, you know, this case is over once the jury hears that.
Uh-huh.
Because what then happened is within, I think it was 2 or 3 days after that entry is when this $1 million worth of accounts got changed to go all to the son. So, and you know, it said the son, her son blank is here with her in the appointment.
Right.
So it was like, okay, well, here you go. This case is over.
You know, that leads to the issue of, and I would assume that the other big issue that you deal with on a regular basis associated with mental capacity is that that the resultant issue of undue influence. Is that difficult? Well, I'm wondering, is that difficult to prove in light of the fact that you've got to have all these witnesses? Is that a difficult challenge?
It is. You know, undue influence, in many cases, you're looking at the document, I would say, the will, and you're backing your way out of it. And what I mean by that is that, you know, one of the things you look at in a will caveat is, did the will that's in question alter the existing estate plan of the person?
Uh-huh.
Or does it leave the assets in a way that is, you know, questionable?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's say that, you know, we have the person who has two children and has always left everything equally to the two children.
Right.
Well, if the will was signed, you know, late in life, at a time when the person was feeble, and then, you know, one of the children was left out completely, and the one who was not left out was, you know, maybe local, maybe even living with the person, maybe,
right,
you know, kind of protecting the person or keeping the person, so to speak, protecting, keeping people away from her or him, then, you know, that those are all suggestive, right, of there being some undue influence. If you have all of a sudden a caregiver shows up in the will, you know, and they receiving a significant you know, portion of the estate, then that may be suggested of undue influence as well. But, you know, you understand that, you know, your average, you know, 50-year-old is not going to be that susceptible to undue influence if they have all of their capacity. Mm-hmm. They're going to make whatever decision they want to, and if they want to leave everything to the caregiver, then that's fine, you know. Mm-hmm. But if you have someone who's, in most cases, you know, in advanced age, and then their medical records indicate that they were, you know, feeble or weak or those type things, and that's going to be, of course, more suggestive that they're more subject to potentially being unduly influenced by others.
Wes, Cecil, final question before we wrap things up here, and I want to go back to the outset of the conversation, and we've done a series of conversations on the issue of will caveats or will challenge. And you said something a few moments ago, Wes, that it leads right back to how we opened the program. You mentioned multiple cases related to the medical records where you've utilized those in will caveats. And so, Cecil, West, are we looking at a situation here where folks have, of course, obviously, there's a greater transfer of wealth. Let's just acknowledge that right out of the gate. But because of the baby boomers. But are we seeing situations here, an increased number of, I'll use the word of deficient wills or wills that are questionable? And if so, what is the cause of that? And that's a little bit of a speculative request on my part.
Lockwood, I think a good place to conclude this topic, because we've worked on it for a few weeks here, and it's a good place to conclude, is all of this begins with the genesis of making out a will.
Right.
Where is the will made? Is it off the internet, or is it at a reputable lawyer's office?
Mm-hmm.
How is it executed? Who is in the room? Is the caregiver in the room? Is the undue influencer sending emails to the lawyer, telling the lawyer what to do?
Mm-hmm.
Are there independent witnesses executing the will, witnessing the will? Have any medical records been obtained on the front end to document that the person is competent and doing well at the time that they signed the will? So there's just a myriad of issues. We've talked about what happens when a will is challenged in the will caveat. But on the front end, let's don't get there. That's what
right.
we really desire, isn't it, Lockwood?
Yeah,
and of course, Wes agrees. We don't want to have to be in the courtroom to begin with. And so it is very important that our listeners understand the value of having the right lawyers, the right kind of advice, and to follow certain privacy issues and just a myriad of things that an experienced estate lawyer will flag. When I get emails from caregivers, from children, telephone calls, you know, kind of telling me what Mr. Jones wants, that's a red flag, Lockwood. I can't listen to what Mr. Jones wants. I've got to talk to Mr. Jones himself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And many times I need to speak with Mr. Jones singularly and without anyone in the room with me at that time. Uh-huh. Many times I need to meet with Mr. Jones on more than one occasion. Many times I need a medical record before I'm comfortable having Mr. Jones sign a will. We are always thinking, will caveat, let's avoid it. On the execution side at the very beginning. And I think that's a good place to conclude the program, is that it's very important to have good lawyering from the very beginning.
And by the way, I just want to remind everyone, you're listening to Harvell and Collins, and you can reach out to them. Go to either the web, harvellandcollins.com, spell out the word and, or give them a call, 252 area code 726-9050. And with that, Wes Cecil, thank you very much for this afternoon's program. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Lockwood.